Filmmaker Commentary, episode 24. Welcome to Filmmaker Commentary, where we give you insights from our favorite filmmaking commentaries. These commentaries can be heard on your DVD and Blu-rays of your favorite movies. We'll show you how you can use these commentaries and apply them to improve your video production and filmmaking techniques. All of this here on Filmmaker Commentary. I'm your host, Reginald Titus Jr. Welcome to another episode of Filmmaker Commentary. I'm Reginald Titus Jr. I'm joined with
Casey G. Smith.
Welcome back, sir.
Good to be back, sir.
So today we talk about The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It was made in released in 2011, had a budget of $90 million. The box office was $102 million domestically and $130 million internationally for about $232 million worldwide. Is that a win or no?
Well, it depends on that. Again, that P&A budget.
Right.
It's walking the line. I think it's kind of walking the line to put $90 million into, a mystery thriller.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of visual effects, which is kind of the standard with Fincher. Some beautiful effects, but
right.
A lot of digital effects in this.
True.
It wasn't quite enough to get them the sequel. So it wasn't enough of a win. Critically acclaimed, but not enough of a financial win.
Got a point. It was nominated for 5 Oscars, including with Rooney, nominated
Best
for
Actress.
Best Actress, yeah. And it actually won for Best Editing. So
those guys put in work.
Yeah, they did. Deserving.
Man.
The thing about his budgets always trip me out, because when we look at Ridley, like, he keeps his budgets pretty low and he's in sci-fi.
That's a fantastic point. And both guys take a lot of time in pre-production.
Yeah.
And are very, very hands-on, very involved. And then they both enjoy, obviously, digital.
Yeah.
But David loves digital and both are very, have a little element of OCD. And I think with some auteurs,
yeah,
they're both auteurs.
Right.
That's kind of what it takes. And I think Fincher maybe sits right in between Ridley and maybe Guillermo del Toro in terms of, mm-hmm, kind of like the budget aspect.
Yeah.
Guillermo's known for going real far sometimes with the budgets, and that sometimes hinders certain projects.
Yeah.
But Fincher seems to get, I guess, the budget that he wants. And
he does, but
he uses every penny of it.
And sometimes goes back. Like in Fight Club, had to go back. When we listen to like Ridley's commentary, he kind of almost like brags about how he will reuse sets in a certain way, being frugal. And maybe that's because, you know, him having a production company and, you know, a lot of times raising the money for this stuff. I don't know, but it's very two different ways of kind of approaching the same thing. Like if Ridley was to do this, and even me just looking at the film, it's like that could have been cut in half. Just do you really spending a little money on the digital? You know, when he did the digital part on her hair,
like, yeah, I saw that.
Like how much was that? Like $20,000 probably.
Wow.
You know, like
for a couple of frames.
Yeah, like,
you know, one scene.
Like little things like that, like I understand, you know, it's important to him, but like in the grand scheme of things, that starts adding up.
He wants you to be sucked in and locked in
right
every step of the film. And I can't argue with necessarily the results, because the films are beautiful. We've
they
covered
are, yeah,
several of
this
his
one's
films
solid
now. Man, it's a gorgeous film.
It's straight up like a masterclass. You know, it's like, what do you, there's nothing left to do. You watch that and it's like that. No improvements. You win.
Seriously. With a very highly beloved character, intellectual property.
Maybe it's the budget allows, maybe it's not necessarily so many special effects, but maybe the time. Because Rooney had talked about in this article that I'm reading a little bit that it took him like a year to produce this, to shoot it. And maybe that's where a lot of that money is going, to the labor that it takes in order to, instead of like, all right, we have 45 days to shoot, we have 6, you know, to spread that over a year. You know, maybe that's where a lot of that money is going to, so that you can kind of take your time and do multiple takes.
Right, because we know that there's definitely going to be multiple takes, even with some shots that you would think would seem simple. There's a lot of coverage. Fincher gets a lot of coverage on a lot of scenes.
Dude.
Often rocking two cameras, you know, maybe like per setup, and then, you know, getting the reverse of that.
I was
the master shot.
There's a scene where Daniel Craig is in the I guess it's some eatery. It's a restaurant.
Yes,
in the middle. Did you
scene.
See that?
Same scene.
Oh
yeah.
Oh my God.
And
like
they showed all the
9 angles.
Yeah.
They
that's
shot
exactly
that on 9
what I'm talking about.
Of them just sitting down and looking like, what are you doing? Like I bet the editors were losing their mind. Like I
they mentioned that in some of the behind the scenes, how they mentioned coming off of Zodiac was one thing,
right?
But then coming to this one, they said it was very difficult, like sweating blood, you know, in going through the process of the editing.
Yeah. So we definitely appreciate it, but sometimes you just kind of see the American excess sometimes.
But again, it's so difficult to argue with the results from a sheer cinematic standpoint. True. From an artistic standpoint,
there's nothing this really wrong with it.
Yeah, this guy is a master.
Yeah.
Monetarily speaking, I mean, it was enough where the Sony was looking at doing a sequel.
Yep.
And the rumors continue to persist that it was, you know, money. It came down to money as far as, you know, what to put in towards another one, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more.
Right. Again, the presentation of this Blu-ray comes with two Blu-rays. One is, you know, the film with a commentary. Another one is just all the behind the scenes and the visual effects montages and interviews. It's almost like up to 4 hours worth of material.
Does yours come with a DVD also?
Dude, yeah, it has a DVD that looks like it's been written on.
Yeah, looks like it's a burnt. It looks like it's like a straight up like a DVR.
Yeah,
it's packaged that way. That's pretty brilliant.
Just like Fight Club, just like all his other things, like the art direction on the actual Blu-ray tells the story, and then when you go inside the actual Blu-ray, that tells a story. You've like it's a location where you've seen in the movie, in the actual special effects on the special features.
Speaking of, there will be spoilers. If you're tuning in to Filmmaker Commentary, number one, we definitely encourage that you have watched the film. Totally worth watching. And, of course, then come back and listen to us talk about the commentary. But you're totally right. It's the menus on this Blu-ray are some of the best I've seen as far as just immersing you in and how they tie things in, where they even put like words.
Yeah,
it's amazing. It really is amazing. When I was going through the I think maybe the locations, and I was trying to get back to the next page, but amongst the, because it's kind of set up like almost like a library, like the library scene, the card catalogs and all that, and documents and files, and some of the words are kind of hidden in the files, the back and menu were hidden in the files. I'm like, oh, I didn't even see them there. I was just tickled pink.
Well done.
Yes.
So my memory of the film, watching it this time, I actually enjoyed it more this time. So the first time I watched this was around like 2012, 2013. My memory of it, of course, like the brutal stuff, dude, like that's just seared in your brain. You know, you see that, it's, you're done.
Can't unsee it.
Yeah, you can't unsee it for sure. And then remembering how Rooney, how much time she spent on this character and how iconic this character was to her and everybody around the world, basically. But that's all I really remember. I remember they caught the guy, or the guy died at the end, the one that was torturing all these women. But a lot of stuff I really forgot about. Mm-hmm. So when I went back, watched the film, and then did the commentary. How did you watch it this time around? And when was your first time watching it?
So the first time, I actually watched it in the theaters. I remember seeing the previews, the trailers, and the original Swedish version was on Netflix at the time, if I'm not mistaken. But I never watched it. I've seen very little. After I saw this one. So this was really my first experience. But yeah, me and my buddy, we went, saw it in the theater. That opening sequence, watching that in the theater with the music and the sound and the Trent Reznor score, I was like, what is this? I was taken. And I was already digging Daniel Craig from being in Casino Royale. I remember I enjoyed it, and yeah, I was definitely shocked by some of the scenes. And then once it came out on Blu-ray, my buddy, he had purchased it, and I said, hey man, you got to let me borrow that. And I began to dive into all the behind the scenes stuff. So that was a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And so I hadn't seen it since then. So let's say maybe 2013 or somewhere around there was probably the last time I saw it. So this, and I still don't know why I tend to forget a lot of the details about it.
Yeah,
I don't know why it didn't quite stick.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know there was a missing girl and things of that nature, and he's dealing with his family. So I went in and watched it again, and it's like, oh man, there's so much. There's a lot going on, and some of it even has a little bit of confusion. I'm pretty good about following films, but it's like I'm really focusing.
It's almost like the Zodiac one. It's I'm glad that he didn't spend so much time for us to try to figure out like all the details. Because I was kind of catching myself like, what does this mean? What does that mean?
Did I miss something?
Yeah. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to trust it this time. Like, I don't want to try to figure it out in my brain. You know, it'll be revealed to me.
Well, here's a fascinating thing. They actually mentioned in the commentary that they actually do that on purpose. Like, when she's in the library, she's going through all that stuff.
Yeah.
They say, well, you know, is it going too fast for the audience to figure out? And it's like, well, this scene is not for the audience to figure it out. This is for you to see the pace at which Salander that she works at. So it's not for you to be able to fully be able to process it all. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, but just showing kind of the contrast between how both of them work and the speed at which she gets boom, 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 is going through all this data, all this info, and connecting dots. We know she's connecting dots. But yeah, it's like, I'm like, oh, okay, I don't feel dumb now. All right, I appreciate that. But yeah, that's actually done with effect. And somebody said also that if it feels confusing to the audience, instead of slowing down and explaining it, say, no, instead go faster.
Hey, I'm with that, man. I was like, ooh. Because going back to Zodiac, that, oh, dear God, I was like, I'm done. Like, this just needs to be a documentary and then move on. This should not be a film.
Man, how do you really feel, Reginald? Oh, how do sorry. You really feel?
Sorry.
So, but yeah, this time around, I
yeah, he crushed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed every time that I see it. And actually, with one thing I forgot to do, which I should have done with the commentary on Fight Club, mm-hmm. is that when I watched it this time, I remember that trick of I just hit on my PS4, I hit the fast forward button once to get it to go through it at 1.5 speed. And that for Fincher's commentary is perfect because you can still understand all the dialogue and it kind of puts them at a perfectly
fine pace. What, 2.5 hours this film?
Yeah. So it allowed me to get through it just quick enough, still keep me engaged, and then go and watch some of the special features. So that's like, was perfect for the commentary. Yeah, the 1.5, bam, let's go.
In this film, it feels like there's like more, there's like four or five acts.
Five acts.
Because like, you know, they solve it, the guy, you know, they kill him, whatever. And then, okay, you're kind of satisfied. But it's like, oh, wait a minute. They still got to solve the whole missing girl thing. Mm-hmm. And then so they solve that. It's like, okay, that's the fourth act. Then she goes on to like take down the guy that started out this whole film of bothering Daniel Craig and got us all down this little wormhole. And so yeah. She closes that out. I'm like, dear God. But it was still entertaining.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, yeah, I'll stick around. Right. Yeah, I'll stick around. What's next? Okay, all right, I'll stick around. And you've become so invested in these characters, and it's so fascinating because they start off totally separate.
Yeah.
And then we see how their paths converge, and they get on this, you know, this singular focus and mission, and then they wrap that up, and then, yeah, they're finishing up his aspect, and at the same time she's growing and coming into her own as well. Yeah. So even when it ends, you're like, it's not a traditional quote unquote happy ending,
right?
But you're like, they've both grown.
Yeah.
And they don't necessarily need to be together.
Yeah. You're satisfied.
Yeah.
Almost. But you're like, when's part two coming out?
You exactly. know? Like, I want to see more of her.
And that's the thing. Like, and it has to be in the Fincher way. I'm going to read this article. But anyhow, this is part one of like a trilogy, right?
Yes.
And the author, what's the author's name of
the
day?
The author's name is Stieg Larsson, and forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that first name, or maybe it's Stieg, S-T-I-E-G Larsson.
He created these, you know, this trilogy that just blew up. I believe he passed away in 2004. Hopefully I'm getting the date right. But anyway, the author passed away. So there's this trilogy. And we're assuming when this came out that, of course, there's going to be a part two and a part three because this was great. This film, great. Well done. Maybe part two and part three. And I didn't see the original versions either. I did see them as well on Netflix, but I didn't, you know, once you see, it's like you got to make a decision in life. It's like either you're going to, if you go ahead and invest with the American version, you're there. If you're going to go with the Swedish version, then I think that you wouldn't like the other version because you get attached to those characters that you're kind of used to seeing. So let me read this article from Yahoo. While speaking with Mara about her new film, Una, the actress revealed to Yahoo Entertainment that it wasn't entirely her decision to exit the series. She quote, "I was hopeful to come back, but they decided to do a different thing. It was always a character I wanted to revisit, but that's not what happened." At the time of Dragon Tattoo's release, what Mara hoped would happen is that the film's creative team, including Fincher and co-star Daniel Craig, would reunite for adaptations of Larson's next two novels, The Girl Who Played with Fire and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. While Dragon Tattoo received critical accolades and 5 Oscar nominations, including Best Actress for Mara, it didn't become a box office behemoth that Sony necessarily hoped for, leading to reports that the sequels were being delayed over budget concerns. "We made that movie for an entire year, which in movie time is unheard of," Mara remarks of the experience she had with Fincher, enjoyed shooting the original film. "It was one of the most incredible experiences I'll ever have in my life, I'm sure. I still feel very close to it. Some of those people are still my dearest friends in the whole world. Making it without them would have been very strange." Because of the sense of kinship for the character as well as the film's crew, Mara remembers feeling frustrating while waiting for official word on whether the next two Millennium films would be made and with whom. Then at a certain point, she realized that she just had to let the experience go, especially once it became clear that Fincher wouldn't be behind the camera again. Sony's decision to move directly to The Girl in the Spider's Web, the fourth book in the series and the first not written by Larson, who died in 2004, tempered her enthusiasm as well, noting nothing would have matched that initial experience, Mara says now, confessing that she still hasn't read The Spider's Web. "Different director, different author of the book. I would have loved to have done it, but I think it would probably have been a letdown in a way. It never would have matched the experience I had." So, there you have it. And I also read, I'm not sure the name of the new director.
Fede Alvarez.
He mentioned that the reason that he didn't want to go with recasting them is because he believes that as a director, 50% of the job is doing your casting, and if he uses them, then it's basically, you know, Fincher, you know, I'm just kind of copying what he's already done and kind of just taking that work. So it's like, I really didn't want to see everybody, the whole crew, the whole gang get back together again and just knock out the trilogy from my own personal standpoint. And then to think that they're skipping those two movies and going straight with the fourth one, I was like, okay, maybe it's just a straight up business decision. But when I saw the trailer and saw the other lady, you know, the other actress, I was like, oh, well, you know, lose some, win some.
What I find fascinating also is that with this iteration, the girl in the spider's web is that the actress who's playing Elizabeth Salander this go round, she actually plays on the Netflix series The Crown, which has received a lot of critical acclaim, where of course she is playing a young Queen Elizabeth. Her name is Claire Foy. Mm-hmm. So once again, you have an actress that we've seen in a more refined space all of a sudden going into this very antisocial, very different, eclectic, dark character. So it's interesting that Fede Alvarez would go through a similar process to take a chance on an actress that obviously has chops, but going, well, almost typecast in choosing Claire Foy.
Yeah, so it's kind of unfortunate that they're just going with the fourth installment, but hey, you know, good luck. Hopefully they knock it out the park. I saw the new trailer. It looks interesting.
It does. I will probably go in and check it out. I mean, you know, this Fincher's film did enough to interest me in the character, and eventually I do want to watch the trilogy, the original trilogy, because again we've talked about Noomi Rapace. Obviously we enjoyed her in Prometheus and her performance there. So I'm very fascinated to finally sit down and, you know, watch it with the subtitles and get through the sweetest version of it, which I think will be fascinating also if the director, the cast and crew, if everybody is truly from that land, like what it looks like. And I've only seen a little bit of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, that original first version. But
I definitely want to check out that trilogy before seeing the fourth installment. Just to kind of have the continuation going on. Who knows with the new author, how far off that they go from the blueprint.
Yeah, I'm curious to see where Salander goes, because now she's a, what did Fincher call her, a billionaireess, because she's got all this.
So yeah, so what happened in that last, because they didn't really kind of go into detail, she gets the $50,000. What is she using the $50,000 for?
She uses the $50,000 to create a fake identity, hacks the guy's account,
okay,
makes herself look like to look like she has money in the first place. It belongs mm-hmm. to the space that she's going to when she goes to the city of Zurich, I believe. Hacks the dude's accounts, transfers them into bonds, and sends that money into four or five separate accounts. Just like steals all the dude's money and apparently the Russian mob's money, which is why that guy ends up getting whacked at the end.
Right.
And then returns Daniel Craig's investment. So she has...
So she has all that money in bonds?
Yeah, in separate accounts.
Okay.
Maybe it's not bonds, but she's got the money. Okay. That's why after she goes into the first bank and then we see her on the bed and she's kind of like going through. Yeah, and she takes those and then she puts them into some other four or five different accounts.
Okay.
Yeah, she drained them, jacked them, using her skills.
Mm-hmm.
Just totally destroyed this dude to the point where, again, the mob was like, hey, where's that money? And they whacked the guy. And then gives Daniel Craig his money back and goes a separate ways. So I'm really curious, like in the girl kicked over the hornet's nest, I'm like, man, she's got all this money
mm-hmm.
and has her freedom. And she's still a little cray-cray. She's crazy, self-confessed. So where does she go? So yeah, I'm intrigued to dive into those stories to see what happens in between.
So adaptation, of course, David Fincher does not have a problem with adaptation. I think he's more like a visual interpreter. He did, you know, Fight Club, which was based on a novel, interpreted that. And even though he's getting these books and they're adapting them, it still feels like David Fincher's stamp is all over it.
I mean, so visually strong mm-hmm. and cast so well, right? So it prepares. I mean, we've talked about it time and time again, his pre-production and pre-visualization and scouting. I mean, at every phase, he's meticulous.
And how about that... the opening sequence, the title sequence. What song is that?
So that's a song. It's the same song that's actually used in Thor Ragnarok.
Okay.
It's called The Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin, if I'm not mistaken. So, but it's a different take. He reached out to Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails mm-hmm. fame. And Trent Reznor did a remake of the song, and he brought in a female vocalist. And I love how Fincher talks about how it's a little kind of almost inside of Salander's head in her mind. Maybe like her worst nightmare or something like that. And I'm like, oh, I never thought of it that way. It's powerful enough as it is, but when you put it in that context, I'm like, oh, wow.
It looks like a music video. Like it looks like a straight up standalone. If you just take off the titles, it looks like a standalone music video. That's what it feels like.
It is hauntingly beautiful. All that imagery and literally dark and black, and then there's wires and dragons and all this. But then when you think that it's inside Salander's head, you're like, oh yeah, okay,
it's a great attention getter, because when the movie starts out, it's just two old men talking on the phone like, oh god, what movie is this?
what did I
just push play. And then then the title sequence come on with this rock song and yelling and screaming and crazy visuals, and like, okay, I'm hooked. What the heck are we about to get into?
It grabs you and says, we're going on a ride.
Giving us just a little bit to keep us going.
Where would you rank that opening sequence amongst opening title sequences?
Probably 10. That's a 10 for sure.
Yeah. Yes. Also, he reached out to Tim Miller
mm-hmm.
to create that. Tim Miller who would go on to, of course, Deadpool fame, because Tim Miller has his own, obviously, production, a digital effects studio.
Right.
So, yeah.
Fincher, like, you got 8 weeks.
All right.
I can't think of any other ones right now. Like, you know, of course, like the 007 Casino Royale stuff and all that. That's memorable.
When I think about that, now thinking about Tim Miller, it makes me think about the first Deadpool,
mm-hmm.
that title sequence.
What happened in that title sequence?
Oh man, it's the car, like he's dropped into a car and he's assaulting guys,
and it's just like rotating.
Yeah, it's rotating, moving around, and the all the credits are like, you know, God's favorite idiot and all kinds of just, you know, poking fun at the cast and crew.
We might have to just do a show just talking about title sequences.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a thing by itself, because you can either like Deadpool, like kind of make fun and kind of know what kind of ride you're in for. Or tell a story. Like, this title sequence is basically telling everything that happened, like, in its own artistic way. Yeah. Or you can just be neat and nice and just show, you know, who was involved with the film.
Mm. Guardians 2. Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Not to go on a comic book trip, but Guardians of the Galaxy 2, a little baby Groot dancing to that song. That's just too cute. Too cute. that brings the energy, lets you know, okay, this is going to be, you know, a fun ride.
In this movie, the cell phone issue. So here's a few points. The cell phone issue, you're going to have to address it in modern cinema. Now, how are you going to address it? And here, Daniel Craig, he's going on to live in this little cabin, and he's still not getting any service with his cell phone. Nope. He's on an island where there's billionaires, and he can't get cell phone service.
Maybe they don't want you to have cell phone service. No.
But it has to be addressed, and because of that, he has to go to a payphone. Don't we like the payphone? So he goes to the payphone to talk to, you know, I forgot the guy that's giving him. Is it a police officer, ex-police officer that's kind of giving him information?
Yes. Why isn't there a landline in his little cottage?
I don't know.
Because there's electricity because there's a refrigerator in there. Yeah. And he's got his laptop in there, so he's got lights. Why is there no landline? Anyway.
I don't know, man.
Keep things interesting, right? Yeah.
So that's how they addressed the cell phone issue. You can't get no service. Because you solve a lot of stuff when you can just get on that phone real quick. Okay, let's talk about some themes of the film. Dealing with loss of respect, loss of a loved one, dealing with friendship, relationships as a transaction.
Yes.
You're dealing with broken institutions. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit more. And money and loyalty. So that's some of the themes. This movie hits on a lot of tough and real themes.
So from Fitcher mentions within the second act or so, when we see Salander interacting with Bierman, when she's going there to, obviously her ward has gone to a medical condition like a coma and you know, has lowered brain activity. And she has to, of course, go to him to get funds to live life. And this, he obviously sees her, and the way Fincher describes it, he's not necessarily somebody who would prey on just any person or any woman, but specifically because of the way that she kind of has a lack of respect for authority, that triggers something in him where he targets her.
Right.
And then, of course, then you know, basically forces her to perform oral sex for her money. But when he does it in a context of saying, you know, you do something for me, I do something for you, making it seem that, trying to teach her a lesson almost that in order to have healthy relationships, it's about, you know, some kind of perverted compromise. You know, for her to get what she needs, she has to open up herself in a way that's not healthy, which is totally not true. We see that just weird, unhealthy transaction take place there. And even to a degree with Daniel Craig even taking on the project with the Wenger family. He's going in and while the uncle wants him to find, you know, what happened to the young girl, how she is murdered. Oh, what's her name?
Harriet,
there we go, right there. How, you know, Harriet was murdered. You know, he makes offers of you know, double his salary, and he'll quadruple it if he finds something. But really, within the context of that relationship, what he really wants, the real hook, is that, hey, I've got financial records on this company that, you know, embarrassed you and took your money. And so, again, that relationship is built on, at the end of the day, a transaction.
Yeah.
Is what's wanted out of it at the end of the day. And even, I think, to a certain degree, between Daniel Craig's relationship with Salander, you know, they meet, and it's initially about a transaction. Once he finds out that she has basically hacked and gotten his information, he's kind of impressed by that. And once she meets him and he's tracked her down, she's kind of impressed by that. But their relationship goes forward because he offers an opportunity for her to do a job. It's a transaction, you know. Mm-hmm. Hey, well, you want to jump in on this gig? And she's
like, and the way they hook each other in, so like would you say with Daniel Craig and his character, the way they were able to capture like the promise of something, mm-hmm. like you can do this, you know, and that kind of lightens his, like he wants to fix his career, so that will help out.
You do this for me, I do this for you.
Mm-hmm. And then with Salander, Daniel Craig was like, hey, this is a man who kills women, and so that lightens her up.
Right. He finds that. Yeah, you find that thing that speaks to them, and then that's what they use to hook.
Yeah.
And again, we all have things that drive us, so the right motivations, but yeah, in many of these relationships within this particular film, we see a bit of that. And then the other theme of broken institutions, we see that throughout. From the get-go, well, we see that with Daniel Craig and him being in the media, having, you know, he comes out, and he's being surrounded by, you know, the press and maybe some paparazzi after he's experienced being called a liar and a slanderer and a libelist by a corporation.
Yeah.
Because there is, you know, a bit of brokenness within the institution of, of business, of finance, maybe even within, you know, the law and in the justice departments, not just here in the States, but obviously in other countries potentially as well. Not saying specifically this is happening in Sweden, but just in a general commentary sense, we see the broken institution of the family.
Yep.
Obviously within the Wenger family, man, dark, twisted.
Got Nazis still alive.
Unapologetic, you know, it's kind of on the low. We've got incest, mm-hmm. and probably some corporate greed. If they were to dive deep into their records, you'd probably find some greed. You don't own an island just by being squeaky clean, more than likely. but yeah, that family is broken. We see a broken system, how children are taken care of within the adoption system, well, the welfare system, mm-hmm. And we clearly see how that kind of comes to a head with Salander's character. So yeah, at multiple steps, we're seeing broken systems, and to a degree, she kind of addresses at some point, kind of addresses each of those in different ways, mm-hmm. Towards the end, the financial, the justice, that family. She kind of comes in and in her own way brings some resolution specifically into some of those situations.
So filmmakers out there, have a theme or something that you feel that resonates with you that you can tell throughout, have a theme throughout your story that people can relate to. Another tip is, you know, some of the sounds that you can use in the film, they notify you, kind of tell you more about the scene. So when Zoolander is going to get the check from this, well, she has to go get money from this counselor because she's a ward of the state. That's, I guess, in their system, it's set up so that if you are a ward of the state, you're given like an allowance, basically. So she has to go to this guy to get this money.
Almost like a caseworker.
Yeah, but some corrupted caseworker. And so while she's going up to his office again, I believe this is the second time she's going to his office. And mm-hmm. you hear the guy like cleaning up the floor with one of those big old dust mops. That sound notifies you of like how late it is.
Yep.
And like she may be in trouble because it's just them two there outside of the guy that's actually cleaning. Then she might be in trouble. And of course she is.
She is. And also one thing I didn't notice the first time, when you think about the questions that he's asking her, mm-hmm. he's asking her like intimate sexual questions. Have you ever had an STD or things like that? Because he's already plotting.
Yep.
He's already plotting when, okay, what's going to be safe for me to do?
So after that whole scene goes down, that's just something you can't unsee after that whole scene goes down. Like, I'm thinking from like an acting standpoint, like how open they have to be to this, to be true to their characters. Like, that actor, the guy, he'll always be seen as a scumbag, you know, just because, you know, he's using his real face and everything.
He talks about how playing the character, how it affected him also, even like after the fact, like trying to get over it, get past it, move forward. It affected him personally, having to go there and do those things. I can only imagine being, you know, at the premiere and actually, you know, watching it all cut together and sound effects, or even having to go in and do the ADR for that kind of stuff. Because we got a chance to see Rooney Mara do some of her ADR in the special features, but that probably would be haunting.
Unbelievable. So also, you know, visual cues. There's a shot after that scene, after the whole, I guess, there's like two rape scenes, like one's, you know, she's performing oral sex, and then there's another one where she's actually raped, tied down. And right before that, there's a visual cue that David Fincher uses, and it's a shot where the camera goes over her head, just like from behind her, and then goes over her head, and of course she's upside down, and kind of visually showing you that, you know, her world's upside down, and she's kind of plotting on how this revenge is going to be. She's got this red hot fan that's like blowing on her, and it's like, okay, what is she thinking about?
Exactly. But even before that, one thing I did notice the first two times that I saw it is how she was already, and she mentioned this actually after the fact, that she was setting him up when she first went to his apartment the first time.
Like, yeah.
It was, she already had the camera there and had planned on capturing him, but didn't realize that he would go to that depth.
Right.
She didn't realize he was going to be raped. But the fact that she was already plotting and planning for a way to get out and to frame him up, but it just went sideways.
Yep.
But she's always trying to think and plan to be a couple steps ahead, which may come from the fact that, you know, with her previous ward, she was always playing chess. So yeah. She was always probably taught to think, you know, multiple steps ahead.
Yeah, so like the first time with the fan, like that shot that comes up, that was right before she goes to his apartment to get the money, right?
That was after, I think that was after the first time she went, after she was raped, because that's when she starts planning the revenge.
What? I don't know.
Oh, no, well, maybe it was after the, that was after the blowjob, right, after the sexual assault.
Yeah. Hey, it is what it is. So
after the sexual assault.
Because, yeah, so she's planning, and so the plan is, I'm going to record the
guy.
I'm
going to record him. You're right. That is the...
And then after the rape, you know, after the whole rape situation, it's like, okay, what the heck is she going to do?
Right. That's when you see her making transactions and buying the equipment and the goods and the tools to go to town.
Go to town. After, like, you know, kind of talking about the actual, like, rape scene where this guy ties her down and all that stuff, and she's recording on camera through her book bag. David Fincher talks about there's a moment you normally see in the movie, and then there's the moment after the moment you normally see in the movie. For example, like, after the rape happens, you see her, like, slowly, like, putting on her clothes. You see the villain kind of looking over his shoulder, writing. He's writing a check, but he's still kind of like, you know, what's she doing?
He has a look on his face that, I went too far.
Yep.
And he knows when you just, I mean, when you see the bruises on her body.
Yeah.
And she was handcuffed down. And one thing that I just really want to mention is that she has that point where, you know, initially she's screaming, and Fincher said on set, you know, because they had to shoot that multiple times, you know, the coverage and all that. And he said you could see the hairs on people's arms, you know, standing up, just being just like creeped out. And then she made the decision, because they didn't rehearse the scene. He gave her, you know, gave them like leeway on how to work that. But like once he really begins to rape her, she stops screaming. And some audience members initially thought that it was her
like just kind of giving up. Yeah.
But it's really her not giving him the satisfaction of hearing her scream, because that's part of what he wants. Part of his way of punishing her for, quote unquote, being disrespectful to authority is to torture her, in essence. And so he kind of wants her to scream, but she's... gets to the point where she's like, I'm not going to give you the satisfaction.
It's crazy.
Yeah. But after the fact, seeing her hobble, you know, to a motorcycle and then into her home.
She actually walks home.
Oh.
She's walking.
Yikes.
So you see her like just walking down the street, going up the stairs. Then you see like visually she's got the keys. She drops the keys and she's like, dear God.
Because she knows it's going to hurt so bad to bend down. She
bends down, gets keys. Like, you just feel the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's what, you know, Fincher's talking about, those moments after the fact. And it kind of, and it dramatizes and illustrate the character conflicts.
But it also endears us to her as well. Like that act is so horrendous and so sickening, where you're like, man, how could somebody do that to another human being? And the other part is also like, I hope you get that dirty, you know, SOB. Like you wanted to extract, you know, you wanted to get this Joker back in the worst way.
She gets all of the stuff and then she comes back. And Fincher talks about, you know, she's like, I need some money for food. That's what she says when he opens the door. He's like, sure, come on in. And then as soon as she comes in, she looks down the hallway. And so Rooney asked David Fincher, like, why am I looking down the hallway? Like, what's the whole point of this?
Mm-hmm.
And as a director, you got to know, like, you know the motives of your character so that you can communicate that to your actors. And he was like basically saying, you want to kind of see how far you got to drag this guy, because this is a big dude and you're like 90 pounds.
Yeah, he said specifically, you're trying to figure out whether you're going to need to drag him by his feet or by his hands.
Oh, well,
based
on
the distance, like, are you going to have to drag him by his feet or by his hands? Or do you need to wait till you, like, get into the room before you, like, tase him? You know, I'm like, oh, man, that's so in-depth. That's smart. I'm like, wow.
It's crazy. So she looks down the hallway, and you see her, you know, looking to the left. She kind of towards the camera, and then she just turns around. Bam! Electrocute this guy in the neck. He just falls to his knee, face plants.
Oh, man. And she's so matter of fact, you know? Because even as she utters a sentence to him, just like, bam, like just clockwork. Bam, knocks him out. I wonder to a degree if the guy actually urinated on himself. Because when you see, after she, you know, gets her revenge, and they show a scene of the hallway. Or maybe it's actually right before, then they show the scene of the hallway.
Oh, yeah, it is wet.
Yeah, it's a little wet. I'm like, this dude, like, you know, lose bodily control, lose some of the functions, which sometimes can happen when you get tased. So I was curious about that. I was like, huh.
It was wet in there.
Yes, sir.
And then you see David Fincher pay homage to Blade Runner.
Yes.
She has the makeup on from the very first Blade Runner. What's the actress name, the tall actress?
Daryl Hannah.
Yeah, so she's got the same makeup. Like, okay. So you see other directors kind of paying homage to their films that they like.
We also, later on in the film, we'll see an homage to, he mentions to Dracula, when we see the house on the top of the of one of the hills on the island. He mentions it's an homage to Dracula as well. So yeah, Fincher's giving us some visual shout outs.
And this torture scene, like this rape revenge scene, you know, got this fat guy tied up, sweating, and she kind of shows him that she basically got him and just pulls out this metal dildo.
Yikes. Yikes.
Kicks it in. She doesn't like put it in. She kicks it in, bam!
You're done, son. You're done.
And the crazy part is just like, as an audience member, you feel relieved. Like, you're satisfied. You're like,
you're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like, as this like, things, it's like, you know, they have the sound effect and all. And you're like, ugh! You're like, you deserve every minute of this. Like, okay.
But yeah, but it's like a different, you know, when you see the first scene when he's doing this to her, you're 100% uncomfortable. This one, you kind of grossed out, but you're like, all right. What's next? What else are you going to be doing?
More. We want blood.
Yeah. So the audience is like, kind of like, yeah, get him. So it's interesting how you can kind of control the audience and, you know, using these different devices.
In wrestling, they call it ring psychology, where you get somebody on the underdog's side. And when they make that comeback, you're cheering for him. One of the things, again, you talk about the budget and the digital effects in this film, that they said that he was wearing actually a bikini or whatever, and that they digitally added the butt cheeks, the buttocks, as Fincher said, the buttocks and the other anatomical parts. I was like, I mean, the effects still hold up. Again, with other films that I've seen before,
it will continue to hold up. Like these are ahead; they're on point.
Yeah, that's what amazes me, because this is 2011. There are films I've seen in maybe 2016. And I look at now, I'm like, oh, I can tell that's.
We talked about like how nowadays things are being rushed. Mm-hmm. Like they're trying to beat these deadlines, and these visual effects houses are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, you know, maybe that's part of the budget too, you know, the time. Like, hey, I need y'all for this amount of time. And also keeping in mind that David Fincher has this ILM background, so he knows what it takes to make these things look realistic and how long it's going to take to do that.
That's a good point. That's a good point. But it you can't tell. I mean, if he hadn't said that, I would not have believed it. I'm like, wait, what? That's a real buttock. No, that's digital? Get out. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's mastered that, especially with, you know, the Benjamin Button. Benjamin Button, you can tell a little bit, but Social Network, he's replacing people's faces and all this stuff. It's
one of the things that I noticed that with Fincher that he mentions, he talks about the screenings, you know, the initial screenings and the test screenings, and the reactions from the audiences. He really pays attention to that. He brings those things up, because he mentioned that initially when they had shot a version of this where he was still in his clothes.
They said copping out.
Yeah, because honestly, Rooney Mara, she was pretty naked in her scenes, so they kind of felt cheated if he wasn't kind of stripped.
Oh, when he got his got his revenge, yeah, that he was still in clothes.
Yeah, if he wasn't kind of stripped down, and so they made the
that's funny. The so he's like, I ain't yellow.
They had to reshoot it.
Never call me yellow.
So I got to go. He had to go through and then, you know, shoot it again.
I wonder, like, the actor, like, come on, I'm already.
I'm so sorry. You know how this goes.
You know this. You know what this was.
Assume the position.
So yeah, understand the behaviors and motives of your characters. There's a scene when Daniel Craig finds out who Zoolander is, and he goes to her apartment, and he's going in there. He's looking around. She's taken aback, but he has a motivation. You can tell by he's already got the, you know, the coffee, the food. He has an agenda, and because of that, you know, it forces the other character to kind of adjust to that, and you can see that visually. So keep in mind, know what your character's motives are, and kind of illustrate that with their behaviors. Another thing that I noticed is with Zoolander's character, when she breaks into, well, she didn't really break into, but she hit the dial pad. The dial pad to go and set up the, I'm trying to remember whose apartment that was. I don't know if she set up a camera or she set up some kind of device. When she was breaking in, she had like the flashlight in her mouth, and she's like setting up a whole computer system. But anyhow, before she breaks into there, there's an old lady that puts in a password into the little keypad. Mm-hmm. And Zalander, she's right there. She's smoking a cigarette, and she hears the pad sounds. And while she hears the pad sounds, she's mouthing the word, like the numbers. She's like 4 or 5 or whatever. She's like,
just, she knows the tone.
The tone of the number. And so after the lady calls,
I always wondered about that.
Like, yeah, you can see her mouth moving. Mm. So she's memorizing it, and then she goes right in and she dials the code in. I didn't notice that until like the third time
watching. I hadn't caught that, huh?
So like these little subtle things that you can tell visually that this character's real smart, or she's figuring these things out.
She's got an eidetic memory, almost like a photographic memory. She sees it, she can taint it.
Which leads me to the next point, you know, show your character's traits. So that's a trait of this character, being a quick learner. You can tell more about the characters by their diet. She's eating like ramen noodles and Diet Coke, and she's like a rail.
Fincher makes a comment about her that emotionally she's like a 13-year-old, even mm-hmm. though physically she's 23. And just now saying and thinking about her, let's say if she does have a photographic memory, because Fincher mentions that she categorizes things visually and photographically. Even when she gives the report on Daniel Craig's character to her employers at the beginning, she's cataloged the information visually to a degree, and they kind of want to learn more, and they want her take, her opinion, you know, about him, but she's about the visuals. It makes me wonder, if somebody who has a photographic memory, what happens when they experience something, a bad memory? Mm-hmm. Like, how vivid does that remain and stay with them? You know, so when she's been through being molested, being raped, and also it kind of left a question, had she experienced this kind of thing in this broken system before, if she was foster child? System, yeah. And what kind of memories would she have? And how would that affect one's behavior, you know, insanity, if the memories, bad memories, are that clear and vivid to you? Anyway, just a thought that came to mind.
Also, with Daniel Craig's character, you know, he kind of talks about his smoking habit and how, you know, after going through the stress of, you know, kind of being forced out of his job in a way, leaving his job, that, you know, he starts smoking again, but he doesn't have a lighter. That's like a visual cue kind of saying, oh, okay, he's back on the habit again. He's stressed out.
Visual storytelling, right? Being able to cram in exposition with a simple scene like, oh, okay, I understand by him doing that and them showing that, okay, that's what that means. And then he's also trying to hide it, because obviously before he goes in to see Robin Wright's character, you know, he puts it out and...
Yeah, she keeps him in line.
Mm-hmm. And even at the very end, when she offers him, when Salander offers him a cigarette, you know, she's, you know, out of focus in the window, and he kind of looks up. No, I've quit.
Liar!
For the time, when she's not looking, when she's looking, you quit. That's like, huh.
So there's a lot of photos of the crime scenes and just like the whole backstory of the Vander, is it Vander family?
The Vanger, V-A-N-G-E-R.
About the Vanger family. So there's a lot.
It might be pronounced Vanga. Vanga.
That whole corporation and that family. There's like just a lot of family photos, a lot of history. And
period piece.
David Fincher just talks about like how in order to get all those photos, that had a schedule within itself. Just to shoot photos, yes. To take pictures of all this stuff. You know, they're actually showing the women that were mangled and killed. They had to set that up and shoot pictures of it.
Right. And then with not just setting up the shots themselves, but then printing out the photos on the right, you know, developing the... on the right kind of camera, developing the film, making it look like it's worn and faded, and not to mention the art direction behind it, and the finding the clothing and the models / actors for that. That's a lot of work. That's a whole lot of work. A whole lot of images, because there's some images that, you know, literally they're going down to how many frames.
Yeah.
That image will be on screen, even if it's just Salinger. You know, scrolling by it.
Yeah.
Each image, each document, even that breezes by. They went in and painstakingly created those documents.
Unbelievable. And also to add to, you know, the character traits, like the difference between the MacBooks. You know, Daniel Craig's character has a MacBook. She does, but the way he had is probably like just on default settings. Mm-hmm. Her settings are going to be customized, and it's going to look different. And that's just like subtle stuff that you may not even pick up on.
right? And they well, and they even and again, this is a praise to the acting of and maybe even the direction of Fincher. But when Daniel Craig goes to look up something on his Mac while Salinger is sitting there, he's trying to, oh, let me go in and why did I put that file, you know? And the look on her face is like almost like disgust. Like, you shouldn't even be allowed to touch a computer. Mario Chalmers, you know, it was like, it was, she just looked disgusted, like you shouldn't be messing with this thing at all, like just let me do it, right? It was just, yeah, she was disgusted.
That is funny. Yeah, I remember now. And there's another scene where they talk about IKEA. You know, Daniel Craig goes to the Nazi's house to discover this photo. He's looking for a photo. You know, the Nazi man, he's just like, he's proud of what he's done. He's like, hey, I took pictures of it. Hey, I don't try to hide it. Mm-hmm. And IKEA gets mentioned again. And David Fincher, of course, in Fight Club, talks about IKEA pretty badly. And then it comes up again. So this has to be from David Fincher. And people ask him, like, what's up with you and IKEA? So I found that kind of funny how he finds a way to kind of put his, you know, his take on things. Sneaks it into the films.
He mentioned that with his daughter, that he used to do a thing when she was little where he would pop her back for her.
Oh, yeah.
And she would say, you know, but Dad, you know, you're be careful, you're not a doctor. And then after Daniel Craig gets, you know, he gets shot at, and Salinger's character is there and has the dental floss, and he specifically says a line that Fincher added where he says to her, you know, be careful, you're not a doctor. And that's a specific nod to his daughter. So, yeah, just sliding in some personal experiences, and a little nod to his daughter.
That's cool. I like how artists, they find a way to kind of put their touch on things to let you know that I did this. That's I'm right. The author.
Auteur.
They can tell you where it came from. Locations can tell the story of a character. I know you mentioned about one of the villains in the film, how his house looks perfect. Architecture's nice. He's got everything and on shelving and case. The wine looks good. Everything looks perfect.
It does. And it's all in this clear house. And Fincher mentioned specifically this is a sinister individual that's really kind of like to say hiding in plain sight. He's right there, but he's making himself seem like, oh, I'm open and transparent, yet he's the one that's hiding things.
Yeah.
That speaks a lot to who he is. Even obviously with Salinger, with her character, how her place is set up against a place where normally, you know, she's kind of there by herself. Occasionally strangers get let in, but you know, she doesn't really have much family or friends, really. I mean, we see acquaintances, but we don't see really any friends. But it's this place of solace and isolation to a degree. But yeah, these things are revealing of these characters. They're the places where they dwell and maybe the secrets that they hide.
Did you notice when Daniel Craig first meets the villain and they're sitting down, they're eating dinner, drinking, whatever, you hear like a woman screaming in the background. And he's like, excuse me. Then he walks and he closes the door and then screaming stops. It was kind of creepy. It was like in the background. It was like real subtle. I'll be right back. And he just goes, closes the door, and he comes back, sits down. They drink wine.
This is when his girlfriend is there as well, right?
Yeah. You can hear it. Go ahead, check it out. It's creepy.
I'm about to watch that scene again. Yeah.
And then the villain, he actually talks about when he has Daniel Craig like tied up. Man, the first time you were here, I had a woman here in the basement.
See, and that made me want to go back to that and listen. I'm about to listen to it again.
It's there. It's creepy. It's real low. Man, oh, that's messed up.
That's good sound design though. Those hidden nuggets where you have to go back and like.
Oh, what did you think about the actual like commentary itself? To me, it seemed there was more pauses. Like, you know, I don't know if he was just kind of sitting back and just watching his work. He seemed a little bit more excited explaining this film.
Yes, I felt that, and definitely having it go with the 1.5. So there were obviously less pauses because moving right along. But definitely, I made a note that he always gives credit to where credit is due. I really respect Fincher for that. Actors have had different ideas or production members when they've done something, he gives credit. But he was very, very complimentary of the actors, which again he normally is. I'm not saying it's not. He normally is, but he was very impressed. With Daniel Craig's acting. He talks often about the subtle things that he does in his acting.
Yeah.
Where he's giving away that he's frustrated with himself for not knowing who, you know, a member of the family was that came in to his house, or how he, you know,
wore his glasses down.
Right, when he was searching in at the parade scene, like all these subtle hints to Daniel Craig's acting, to complimenting Skarsgård in terms of how just how he's just so laid back and so comfortable and confident within himself, to talking about all the changes that that Rooney Mara made to take on this role. Yeah, he was just very, very complimentary, and it didn't sound like they had as anywhere near as many problems, even though it was a long process. But I think all of his films are. He doesn't talk a lot about studio interference or just major production issues on this film. It seems like, though it was long and in depth, like you said earlier, that he's matured. And that it was long but fairly smooth. And I think he really knew that he could really, whatever real big changes he needed, he could handle through editing and digitally. And obviously, the editors talk later on about how there are certain frames where certain frames that before they would have thrown out, but now they were able to take those and adjust it how he likes them, and then restabilize those shots to the degree that Fincher likes it. So they were able to continue to use a lot of things that maybe would have required reshoots on this one. But yeah, I enjoyed his commentary, and it did seem lighter and more upbeat. How about you, man?
Yeah, man, it does. He seemed very excited. Seemed not as technical, but just informative, just in general. It didn't seem like, hey, we shot this with a 50mm. You know, he wasn't technical like that on this go-around, but very, very informative. And yeah, it seemed like he liked it.
Let me ask you this. Do you think he was, because in other commentaries, it sounded like he was maybe behind the lens more. This one, I don't get the feeling that he was necessarily behind the lens. I think he was looking at monitors, but I don't get the feeling that he was actually holding the cameras on different shots. Now, that may have been a change in regulations within the different guilds, like the Directors Guilds or whatever, but I don't get the feeling he was behind the camera. Whereas when we talk about Panic Room, he was behind the camera on some of those different shots. But in this one, I don't get that feeling that he was holding the camera.
I don't think so either.
Even look at the behind the scenes, I see him directing people and directing DPs and so on. But yeah, I don't get the feeling he was behind the camera at all.
Because of the unions, he has to have an operator, but I don't think he was just down the operator's neck. Like, to me, he's going to be in Video Village. Like, some directors like to be right in front of the actors where the actors are.
Right.
It's more intimate. Tarantino's like that. Some directors like to look at the monitors and see kind of what's going on. Fincher kind of comes off like that's what he would do. Would look at the screens and make sure they're lined up, and then kind of go in to talk to the actors after.
That's what I was seeing in the special features.
Okay.
That he was. He would go through, make sure things were framed up, and then he was, going in and talking to the actors. Again, I really enjoyed seeing his relationship again, especially with, I always keep blanking on her name, Rooney.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to say Noomi Rapace, but no, this is Rooney Mara. Rooney Mara. With Rooney, they had just a real just nice, sweet rapport with each other. And they would, joke around, but, just you could see there was a good connection there and a trust there. And he could kind of, say what he needed out of the scene or just direct.
Spent a lot of time. And I didn't look at the behind the scenes in regards to, like, character development this time around, but I remember it from, like, 2013. Him mentioning to her that this role is going to change you. You have to be okay with nudity. Mm-hmm. And the things that you, it could go good, it can go bad, but more than likely, like, people are going to see you. This is an iconic role, so you basically have to become this person.
Right, you will have to live with this character. And right before when she kind of knew she had the role, that they were really serious, that he laid out all those things. You have to be okay with nudity. You have to become a smoker.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to fake it. You're going to become a smoker. You will have to cut your hair, piercings, tattoos, and just going all in. And saying goodbye to your family and friends, because you have to become a loner.
Yeah.
And what Fincher didn't know is that, kind of by nature, Rooney is that way. Like she said, I was excited. I was like, hell yeah, I'll be happy to go off on, to an island by myself and get away, because at her core, she is that way.
Mm-hmm.
And even as they progressed later on, and she had to shoot those scenes at the end where she takes on the identity of, with the wig or with the blonde hair, and she's wearing a dress at the end, she hated wearing that. That's like, she crazy. Hated wearing dresses by that point, because she had gotten so used to, in essence, being Elizabeth.
Yeah.
That She couldn't stand it. She couldn't stand wearing the dresses. She's like, I hate these clothes. I hate this wig. And it was really getting to her. I wonder now how she feels about that. I'm sure, you know, her hair's grown out and all that kind of stuff. And she's been in other films. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if she's fully...
The movie she has coming out is called Una. Hmm. And she looks real prissy in that one. Interesting. She's back.
Yeah, but see, but I don't know how much.
How long did it take really, to come out of that, right?
Well, see, I don't know how much of that really, really is her. You know, like, who is she really? Because even who she was in Social Network, she said that wasn't really her.
Yeah.
And that's who Fincher met initially for. She was only on that shoot for 4 days. And yeah. that was
Fincher's first impression. She kind of got typecast, so, you know, because, you know, you look the part. So it was like, you're only going to see that person as that.
Exactly.
It kind of sucks when that happens, but man, she put in the work. And then I can't think of the lady's name that helped her with her character development on what it means to be like this punk rock. Is it punk rock? Will they kill like more punk the style that
goth,
like a goth punk, like a rocker chick,
emo?
No, it's a because the lady that she learned from is that lady. You know,
I know you're talking about her. Let me find her.
Wearing the leather, a little bit more aggressive, kind of got the rock and roll vibe, like she's part of a band, and taught her how to become Zoolander. I'm mixing up with the movie Zoolander.
Trish Somerville. Mm-hmm. Costume designer, yeah. Because she's actually interviewed in the...
And she's like that chick, you know, features. Straight up. You mm-hmm. know, you can tell. She's got that vibe.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to see, were there any other behind the scenes?
I would just say if you're a fan of this film...
Yeah.
Pick up this Blu-ray. It is like most Fincher features, chock full of great pre-production, production, and post-production features. Again, the amount of visual effects in this film, you really have to watch the behind the scenes to appreciate it. When you see what they added in so flawlessly, like this, the train was visual effects. I'm like,
of course it was.
What? The snow flurries that are in these. You
didn't see
scenes.
The green screen. So like when they were on stage, the room where it's all the windows are clear and it's just white through the windows, like the white snow and the fog. Mm. That was green screen.
Madness, I tell you, madness.
Through the window, and then the shot when the cat's coming through the window, like that was on a stage. So like when you look through the window, it was all green screen out there.
Wow.
Hey. And you can't tell, it's so subtle.
No. And again, some of the things that were done on people themselves. So, okay, we mentioned last time at Fight Club, you said how you enjoy the real blood.
Yeah.
Right? So Daniel Craig, once again, when he has been shot at and he's bleeding and he gets put in the shower and she's trying to clean him up, all digital blood.
So it was a mixture, though. So
was it a mixture?
Yeah, so like the part like on his ear, I think like in the ear in that area was... some of the blood, and then when it was leaking from the she's like stitching them up, all that was, that's crazy, like that's very convincing, all that's just digital going down his face.
Yeah, man. Like I guess you know, you have mapping, right? So they mm-hmm. can literally map it like frame by frame to these people, which is, when you think about it, it's really pretty creepy, because what can't you duplicate? I saw an article that's saying that the new Ant-Man and the Wasp movie is crossing a new level of the uncanny valley, which really? Makes me really excited. Yeah, I'm going to see it in the next couple of weeks. Comes out on the 6th, okay. I believe. But you know, they're doing obviously the growing and the shrinking, and but the sense crossing a new level on uncanny valley. Plus, I think they might, you know, in the first Ant-Man, they did that kind of de-aging technology mm-hmm. with Michael Douglas, showing right. him, you know, as the first Ant-Man. I think there's going to be more of that, because obviously Michelle Pfeiffer's in it too. So.
And they did it with Robert Downey Jr. when mm-hmm. they went
Captain
back
America Civil War, right? Yeah. So I'm fascinated to see how that turns out. But what they can do these days is increíble.
Ant-Man. I didn't see the first one.
You didn't see the first Ant-Man?
No. Was it good?
It was enjoyable. It was one of those surprise. It's like when they announced Guardians of the Galaxy and when Marvel announced Ant-Man, they announced them both at the same time, and everybody, comic book fans, said, "Really?" And then, you know, people didn't know that. They were like, they said, "Who?" And obviously Guardians, smash hit, like mega smash hit. Ant-Man was a hit. I wouldn't say smash hit, but it was a hit. He was maybe the least known, but mm-hmm. it was still wildly. That's one of the best, like, also like kind of like family. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like a family film. Even the theme kind of is family. But yeah.
True.
Definitely worth checking out. Ant-Man's a fun film. Yeah, it's a good one.
Back to debauchery.
Masochism.
Right.
And sadomasochism.
There you go.
Yeah. Which, yeah, you know, are kind of not. Yeah,
this one it was more of a sadist.
Mm-hmm.
He uses that word in regards to our villain.
Yeah, man. How about when she hits him with the golf club?
Oh, that was good.
You see the tooth,
dude.
You see the tooth fly out.
Dang, I didn't even see the tooth, but the way he bounced, like when she swung and hit him, just like doop doop bouncing in the blood. I think that's digital as well.
Mm.
And just doop doop. I'm like, oh man, he gets up. My brain's like, hit him again. Like, don't let him run.
Four.
No. She hooks up, you know, Danny Craig. You know, may I kill him? May I shoot him? Whatever she said.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, you may.
Yeah, and even though he talks about the kind of psychology behind that, like she wasn't necessarily asking for his permission, but it's more right. Like, you know, you've heard about these horrible things that happen to women at the hands of these men, and you were about to be a victim of one. Now, do you understand why I would want to take this dude out? You know, now do I have your permission to kill him? Like okay, like I get it. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Girl with the dragon tattoo.
Yeah, good one. Pick it up. We've got a request. Have you seen the movie The Game? It's another David Fincher movie with Michael Douglas. Have you seen that one?
I have not seen The Game.
Oh, that one's...
I don't think I have seen
okay.
The Game. When did that come out?
Oh, God. I don't remember the year.
2000s?
What 90s? Was his first feature? I think it was like right after Alien.
97.
Was it before? Was that before 7? His discography, his filmography throws me off a little bit sometimes.
7 was 95. Yeah, it was definitely after 7.
Okay.
Your Game was 97.
It was 97. Yeah. Okay.
And then Fight Club was 99.
So, yeah. So, The Game came out. The reason I know about The Game is because that's when I started studying. You know, I started studying David Fincher and discovered The Game. Watched that one. And I've been trying to find commentary on it because I haven't found any commentary at all. But I went to a movie trading company about a week ago, and there's a Criterion Collection version of The Game.
Mm.
So, and it has commentary on it. I haven't heard it before, so I'm like,
something new.
We're going to have to check this one out. But before then, we've got a couple requests. So we've had a listener request The Invincibles. He originally said Invincibles 2.
But Incredibles?
The Invincibles? Like, is that even a movie? Like...
It was Unbreakable.
That's Unbreakable.
Invincible is a comic book character. There's a comic book character named Invincible.
Okay, so we got a request from a listener for The Incredibles 2, but of course that's still in the theaters.
Right.
So I said, hey, it has to have a commentary. Maybe we should look at, you know, The Incredibles, the first one, and see if that one has commentary. If that one does have commentary, we'll, you know, check that one out.
Brad Bird.
Okay. If not, we have another one. So the first one was requested by Jonathan Jones Speaks. And then our second request was from CJ Normalized. He said Requiem for a Dream.
Oh.
Darren Aronofsky.
Now that's nice and bright. Yeah. Contrast, so contrast to right. The Incredibles.
Like two ends of the spectrum.
Family film to, yeah, a walking PSA.
Yeah. He had another film. I can't think of it off the top. I don't know if it was called Crass or I can't think of the name of the other film that CJ Normalized. But I know for a fact that Requiem for a Dream, that one does have commentary. I've listened to that one before. So that was when I was going down Darren Aronofsky land.
Well, thank you to our listeners for sharing your suggestions. And please, please continue to send those our way. Reginald, where can they send those recommendations?
So yes, if you go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/filmmaker commentary, just throw in a comment section. Or if you're on, depending on how you listen to this, if you're on SoundCloud, throw some comments in there. That's how our last listeners, how they threw some suggestions in there.
Yeah, and your comments in general, we definitely welcome those, your feedback, and of course tell a friend,
share. Don't forget to leave a review on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you listen to a podcast, because that really helps us out. And until next time, peace out.
Peace.